Numbers don't lie. Like this one. 865,000. That's the number of women pushed out of the workforce in the United States last month. So guess how much more or less the number is than for men. Go ahead. I'll give you a second. Guess. Well, in September, 216,000 men had to exit the labor force. That's a quarter of the number for women. And here's another way to think about it. Of the 1.1 million Americans who were forced out of work or stopped looking for work last month, 80% of them were women. There has been a consistent downward trajectory for women in this pandemic. Double-digit female employment for the first time since 1948. Black women and Latinas suffering an unemployment rate that's almost double that of white women and men. And for so many of these women, there is a family that depends on them. So what is happening to them? From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, we are going to talk about the long-term impact of the she session. Kilsia Moranta lives in Cranston, Rhode Island. She worked at the Omni Providence Hotel there for 21 years until this spring.
Back in March, when everything started, I was at work March 17, and I was returning home. I got this heartbreaking phone call because I wasn't not even, never crossed my mind that I was going to get a phone call. And it was the general manager just providing me with the message that we have to give you laid off due to the pandemic. I felt like I was left in the middle of nowhere, wondering what I was going to do. From having all the support and reliable resources to basically you're on your own, you know, survive. It's like, really? So now what? Can you give me like an explanation? How can I deal with this? Where can I go? How can I get help? I mean, I have, like I say, I have a family that rely on me. It's not like you're only telling me. When something happened to me, you're telling everybody who depend on me. You know, I felt very betrayed by them because I've been there since way before I become a mother. I've been giving you all my energy, all my loyalty, and that's how you pay me back. I had to reach out to the system, I would say. I end up reaching out to the food pantry in the beginning. I applied for food stamp. I called some friends and told them about the situation. You know, I had no job. I don't know if I'm going to be able to provide for my children. How do I face my children and tell them in their face, you might not going to have a meal tomorrow? I mean, that's one thing that no parents want to deal with. At that moment, it's like everything crashed. Like I say, I need my job. I never been without a job. This is my first time in the whole entire time that I live in this country that I don't have a job. So why we are the one being punished? I'm here with my two kids and I live by the day, basically. Whatever I can get today, that's what I deal with. And hoping that tomorrow I found the same way of keep supporting them, you know? It's hard. And a lot of people say, oh, well, why you don't get another job? I say, yeah. It's not bad, but at the same time, you feel like I have spent half of my life in this one place, and I just gonna, you know, be let go just like that. I have that hope that my workplace will open again and things will come back, if not total normal, close to normal, and that's what keeps me going. The hope.
Kilsia Moranta, who worked for 21 years at the Omni Providence Hotel in Rhode Island until this spring. Well, joining us now is C. Nicole Mason, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, who spent decades looking at economic policy and women in the workplace. Nicole, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Meghna, for having me.
Have we seen this kind of job loss amongst American women before?
So, Meghna, before I get started and dive into the numbers, I really want to thank you for sharing the story of at the top of the hour, which, you know, is heartbreaking and very much a snapshot of what's happening for women across the country, or to women across the country. And we're in a moment that there is no historic parallel for women. Not the 2008 recession and not the Great Depression. This is an economic downturn that has disproportionately impacted women, many like the women that we heard from at the top of the hour.
I'm seeing here, just to give a sense as to sort of what we mean by the historic numbers, that those September numbers for women pushed out of the workforce, that 865,000 women in the month of September, that's more than the total number of jobs that were created overall in September, right? I'm seeing that it was something a little over 600,000 jobs created total. So more women pushed out of the workforce than new jobs in this country. And has this been going on? Has this been consistent since that first terrible spasm of unemployment in March and April when the pandemic first hit?
So when the pandemic first hit, women lost about 11.5 million jobs compared to 9 million for men. And we recovered some of those losses. So about 2 million jobs we recovered. But as you just said, a whopping 865,000 women have left the workforce. So even as we had really slow gains or recovered some of those losses, not nearly enough for the number of jobs that we've lost since the start of the pandemic. But we are losing gains. And unless we do something to support women and make sure that they can reenter the workforce, we're going to continue to lose those workers.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about what those supports ought to be. But I do want to understand in more detail the dynamics of what's happening now, Nicole, if we may. How does this differ from 2008?
So in 2008, the economic downturn was in jobs held by men. So construction, manufacturing, production. And even though women did lose jobs during the 2008 recession, it was in no way in the way that we have lost jobs this time around, because the jobs that we've lost since the start of the pandemic have been in sectors that are dominated by women. So the service sector, leisure, hospitality, education. And 85% of those jobs lost over the last couple of last few months have been by women. And when we look at the difference between, you know, when we talk about recovery, women have different challenges than male workers. And that their chief concern, as you heard from the woman who was speaking, is childcare and family issues. And many of them are the primary breadwinners or wage earners in their families.
Yeah. So the woman is, that we heard from, her name's Kilsia. And, you know, and she talked about, as you heard, facing even issues of how to eat, how to provide food for her family. Now, can you tell us a little bit more, Nicole, about are these job losses, since they're focused in certain, not focused, but particularly bad in certain sectors, service, hospitality, et cetera. Is there a sense that women just need to hang on, and that when the things are fully able to open up again, that they could rebound?
So I don't think so. I am hopeful, but I am also very aware of the circumstances that the headwinds. So many of the jobs that we've lost over the last couple of months are not coming back. So there won't be a one-for-one replacement, because some restaurants, some businesses, some hotels have closed for good or have cut down their services. So many of those jobs won't be coming back. And so women will not be able to return to those jobs. So that's, you know, even when we're able to fully open, it's going to take a while for the economy to get back to pre-pandemic levels.
And even if those jobs do come back, Nicole, the sort of crash of responsibilities that women have here is part of the problem. Because if their kids are still going to remote school, or they don't have childcare, I mean, I'm seeing here that the Lean In Institute did a study that found that 1 in 4 women who are working now are considering downsizing their careers or leaving the workforce because of these issues that the responsibilities they have in the rest of their life, they can't meet them right now.
So I'm one of those women that I'm, you know, I work, but I also am responsible. I have 10-year-old twins and responsible for homeschooling. And I can tell you that it's really tough. And I'm fortunate that I can work remotely, and about 30% of the workforce can work remotely. But for women, for many women, most women, they cannot work remotely. And so in order to get paid or to make a living, they have to leave their homes. And so if they don't have care and schools are closed, they have to make a really tough decision. And that decision, more times than not, is deciding to leave the workforce so that they can take care of their families. But they're in a really, that creates another dilemma because they lose income. And for Black women and Latino women who are more likely to be the primary wage earners in their family or the sole earner, that's just triggers a whole host of other issues like food and housing insecurity.
Can you talk more about that? Because the unemployment rate for women of color, particularly Black and Latino women, as you just said, is double right now, almost double than for white men and white women.
Yes, because first of all, Black and Latina women are overrepresented in the sectors that were hardest hit. So in the service sector. And even in the 2008 recession, the same thing was true. They were Latina and Black women were hit hardest. And in this moment, it's really important for us to remember that when we think about recovery, we have to make sure that we are focused on the most impacted.
Well, we are talking this hour about this ongoing women's recession, the she session, and how women are disproportionately being impacted by the recession brought on by the COVID pandemic. See, Nicole Mason joins us. We're going to hear stories from more women throughout this hour. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking about the she session. Usually I'm not a huge fan of catchphrases, but this one's pretty accurate. It's the ongoing disproportionate impact that the pandemic recession has had on working women and their families in this country. I'm joined today by C. Nicole Mason. She's president and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And Nicole, if you'd listen along with us, we talked to a lot of women in preparation for this hour and heard an incredible number of stories. Now, I want to share another one here. Tamisha Isaac. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, and she used to work as an HIV/AIDS outreach coordinator. But when the pandemic hit, her job was not suited for remote work, so Tamisha had to make a tough decision.
Back in March when COVID first started, I actually had to resign from my job and stay home with my kids, who I am the sole provider for.
My name is Tamisha Isaac, and I am a single mom of two boys, one 11 and one 14. They went to school 100% remotely, and that in itself was challenging, different. Living in New York City, if you're HIV positive and you're struggling financially or homeless or whatever have you, there's a program called HASA. And with that program, they were able to assist me financially with housing and with rent until I get myself back on my feet. We actually had to ration food because now we're in the house all day, every day, and I have growing boys, and they consume a lot. And we literally have to ration some stuff and be like, hey, I had to tell them you can't eat everything all at once, because the last couple weeks in the month, I don't have no money to buy food like that. I definitely think that it affects us, you know, most, because for one, we get paid way less than, you know, our male counterparts, and sometimes with the same positions. And, you know, if you're a married couple, you know, you can sort of kind of balance out your finances. But when you're a single mom, or a single parent for that matter, it's a little bit more difficult, because you are the only sole breadwinner and the only sole provider for that household. And it's only that one income that has to provide for everything and everyone. So it's very strenuous. To be honest with you, I have my moments. So on top of being HIV positive, that comes with anxiety, depression. I felt myself somewhat kind of going back there a little bit between March and now, but not fully. So yesterday, my oldest and I had a conversation about something, and you know, he was sad, and he was like, "Mom, I think we all need to go to therapy." And I said, "You know, kid, you're right." So I'm actually working on that. It definitely takes its toll. The upside of all of this was I actually got to spend a lot of time with my boys, a lot more time with my boys. We had these moments where me and my oldest son, because he loves to cook, we would do these cooking things where we would have a cook-off and he would make something that he likes and I would make something that I like. And this time that it has brought me a lot of peace, especially when I was having my anxiety moments, bacon helped me. It helped calm me down.
Tamisha Isaac. She was formerly an HIV/AIDS outreach coordinator and lives in Brooklyn, New York. So, Nicole, Tamisha said something there that I think we really should, well, she said a lot, but something that we should really focus on about the wage gap. Because this year, if I understand correctly, the American workforce overall actually reached a milestone about what more than 50%, or at least 50% of the labor force in this country was women. And at the same time, this very same year, we have this, like, have those gains been totally wiped out?
So those gains have been all but wiped out. So you're right. At the beginning of the year, we were celebrating women being over 50% of the workforce. And I cautioned celebration of that milestone because I knew that although women were 50% of the workforce, many women were still economically vulnerable because of issues like the wage gap. And during this moment, majority of the women who have lost their jobs earn less than $40,000 a year. So that's Tamisha. And what that means directly is that when she loses her job because of the pay gap and because of lower earnings, she doesn't have any savings or anything to ride out this economic downturn. And so it's heartbreaking to hear her talk about rationing food or having the anxiety linked to not knowing where their next meal will come from. We just need to put that in context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what is the long-term impact of this wiping out of jobs and gains for women if, as you said in the previous segment, it's not certain whether those jobs are going to come back? What's the long-term impact for these women and their families?
So for women like Tamisha and the other woman, what we have to know is that, especially the woman who was in her career for 20 years with the same company, over time, women, even though they make less, earn less, especially women of color, it's likely that you get incremental gains over time. And when you lose your job, for many women, working class women, they have to start from the bottom again. At an entry level position. And so those gains that they had made, in the same job for a longer extended period of time, those gains are lost. So it impacts their wages and earnings, but also career mobility and advancement. And I don't believe we're going to recover those gains, or women will be able to recover those gains quickly. It's going to take years, even maybe even decades.
And what does that mean then for the country as a whole? Because we have, when I say we, I mean, in a sense, the 50% of the workforce being women. I take your point about being cautious about celebrating a victory over that. But nevertheless, it was a meaningful milestone. It showed it's a complex milestone, right? Because on the one hand, maybe many of these women are in the workforce because they have to be, because it takes multiple wages to support a household in this day and age. But also many of the women are in the workforce because, in addition, they want to be like society has invested in them, and they are in turn contributing to the economy as productive members of the workforce. If these women have to not just temporarily but perhaps even permanently step back, what's the impact on the country as a whole?
So women are half of the economy. And our wages and earnings are directly pumped back into communities and local economies and in the economy in general. So when women are out of work, that's money not going into the economy, not recycling in and out of local communities. And one of the things that when I said we were cautious about that gain is that many of the jobs that were created or the jobs that women hold, especially in the service in the sectors that have been most impacted, are lower wage jobs. Those are jobs with less flexibility, lower earnings, and less job security. So those jobs were precarious. And because of the wage gap, many women have to take on part-time jobs to make ends meet, especially women who are the primary breadwinner in their family. So it was a great milestone. At the same time, looking at the kinds of jobs that were created or the kind of jobs women held in this moment has shown us that were not enough to be able for women to be able to be economically secure and to support their families.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen just briefly to Beth, who called us from Framingham, Massachusetts. She works part-time and is working remotely to take care of her kids and an elderly relative. And she says that her family is also giving priority to her husband's career.
My husband's position was already the dominant one, where we really had to make sure that we kept his salary and made sure he could do his work. And so my work kind of went by the wayside. And I think that's, women were already in that position. We had already scheduled our family and arranged our work schedules that way so that I could be in the home more and working with the kids and doing things way before the pandemic. So it's just reinforcing these inequalities that are already in place about women having to do the bulk of the domestic and the emotional labor in the family.
That's Beth, an On Point listener from Framingham, Massachusetts. Nicole, stand by here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation now Alicia Sasser-Modestino. She joins us from Reading, Massachusetts. She's Associate Professor of Public Policy and Urban Affairs and Economics at Northeastern University. Professor Modestino, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, respond to what On Point listener Beth just said about having to make these decisions because of the domestic reality at home regarding childcare and what she called the domestic and emotional labor in the family.
Yeah, it's a significant factor. We at Northeastern actually conducted a national survey of 2,500 working parents, ironically between Mother's Day and Father's Day this year, not intentionally, but that's how it worked out. And one of the questions we asked was, what factors affect how caregiving responsibilities for your kids are divided between you and your spouse, partner, significant other, co-parent, whatever. And certainly whether or not which partner earned more was a factor for about 23% of our respondents. But surprisingly, what actually was more prevalent was who was better at taking care of the kids. 33 respondents said that was a factor, as well as, who was still employed, how many hours people were working, and also who had the more flexible schedule were actually even more prevalent, with around 40% of respondents saying that was a big factor in their decision.
So meaning that the women had the more flexible schedules? Am I hearing that right?
Right. So in the cases where, well, this was for anyone who lost a job due to childcare. Uh-huh. We asked them what were the factors that came into play. And so lots of families are weighing, you know, did someone lose a job? If you lost a job, then you're going to get tagged with most of the childcare. If you had your hours cut already, if you were able to work from home, but the other spouse was not, those are all things that came into play. But certainly who earns more, as well as I was really surprised that who was better at taking care of the kids was even a factor in 2020. But that reality is there.
Okay, so tell me more about that. You meaning that you were surprised that in 2020 the idea that, I guess I'm that's a sad laugh. I do not mean to laugh, but it does strike me as being a little old fashioned, but also very real in many households. That when we say who is quote unquote better at taking care of the kids, that presumption is falling on mothers, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and the data from our survey support that too. We asked very specifically how many hours were being spent on various childcare tasks and household tasks. And during the pandemic, among respondents who did not lose a job, so these are all people who are still working, women significantly increased their time spent per week on schoolwork, playing with kids, as well as cooking and cleaning. Men only saw very marginal increases in any of those caregiving responsibilities. And so, yeah, still in 2020, most of the caregiving work is falling on women, just like your caller said. But it seems to be regardless of whether or not who's working, who's not working, and also how much they earn.
Mm. Nicole, did you want to chime in here?
Yes, I want to just say that in general, women are responsible for 37% more care than their partners. And it's even higher for women of color. Mm-hmm. And then during the pandemic, this number has increased. And so I'm not surprised because we still have these very antiquated gender norms, roles and expectations about who should exit the workforce due to childcare demands. And it's usually and caretaking demands, and it's usually women, not men. And so I do think this moment provides us an opportunity to really lean into those stereotypes and unpack them a little bit.
So how would we achieve that?
Well, I mean, I think there's, in terms of, especially this number around 800,000 plus women leaving the workforce, talking about why that is the case and the choice for women to leave, whether it's because of pregnancy or job or earnings, it's always framed as voluntary. She voluntarily left her job. Families made the calculation. But is it really voluntary, especially when we know that women's earnings account for a significant portion of household income? Women derive satisfaction from careers and are also competitive and want to advance. And so have to think about what are the systems and institutions that prevent women from being able to make different decisions about their career and workforce participation.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've just got a couple of minutes before we have to take another break. And Nicole, I know I have to let you go at the break. So let me ask you, we're going to spend the rest of the hour kind of talking through solutions and whether this terrible pandemic and the recession presents us with an opportunity to really advance certain solutions here. So where would you start, Nicole, in terms of supporting women in the workforce and their families?
So I would, there's a host of things, but first I would start at the federal level with some sound policy. So I think this moment is a moment where we might consider a national care infrastructure that really provides childcare supports to women. So thinking of childcare as a public good rather as a private obligation. The second thing is providing paid sick leave and expanding unemployment insurance. And the other thing I just want to say that in the short term, employers have a really big role to play here in making sure that women can not only reenter the workforce, but sustain employment. So flexible workplace policies, paid sick leave, child care subsidies, those are all things that employers can implement right now to help women. Women workers.
I am concerned, though, about just to circle back to it, because I think we cannot afford as a country to look away about the renewed cycle of poverty here that millions of families are facing because of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. So more than 8 million people have fallen in poverty, and that's not even accounting for women many that have been impacted by the current economic downturn were already living in poverty. And so their economic security has, again, once more been compromised. And so I think this moment provides us an opportunity for us to really think boldly about policies that will really move the needle for working women and families.
Well, we'll talk more about those policies when we come back. But C. Nicole Mason, President and CEO of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Alicia Sasser Modestino, stand by for just a second. We will pick up this conversation when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring the ongoing she session, or the disproportionate impact this recession is having on working women in the United States. And it's having that disproportionate impact at all levels of the workforce.
My name is Nancy Weindruck. I am in Arlington, Virginia. And I recently left the workplace, having spent almost 15 years as a healthcare public affairs professional. When the pandemic arrived, I, like many, experienced sheer chaos and unpredictability, primarily because I was in a situation where I was working full time and no longer had childcare for our, at that point, 18-month-old son. And so after great consideration, I made the difficult decision to leave the workplace, but also so I could provide a safe environment for myself, because I am expecting our second child this winter. You make it work, you know, and you work really hard and you take advantage of the gig economy. You know, I'm on Poshmark, I'm on Nextdoor, I'm on OfferUp, I'm selling things and doing everything I can to stay within a very tight budget. So sacrifices are being made. But we talk a lot about this, you know, how this pandemic has exacerbated the pay gap. And you can have, as in our situation, a husband and a wife, same education, very similar careers, very promising trajectories, but statistically, men make more money than women. And the fact that until pay inequity is solved, when a crisis happens, I think that women are going to be hit harder. And I think women will be more likely to leave the workplace in order to care for their children. My mother, she dedicated her life to raising me and my siblings. And while I think we are as successful today because of her, I know that one of her biggest regrets was not having a career. And that was part of the guilt that I felt in making this decision to step out of the workplace was, gosh, you know, not only have you had so many women before us going to great lengths and making such incredible strides, and what am I doing? Am I no longer carrying the baton and moving things forward? But it's also on a personal note, you know, I want to take advantage of these opportunities that my mother didn't have. And so it'll be really interesting to see once this pandemic passes and once things settle down and we feel like we do have the opportunities to have childcare that's reliable and consistent for our son and soon-to-be baby number two, you know, it'll be another hard decision as to whether or not I go back to work. As of today, I am 100% determined to go back to work.
That's Nancy Weindruck. She lives in Arlington, Virginia. I'm joined today by Alicia Sasser-Modestino, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. And, you know, Professor Modestino, what Nancy said at the end there, that she's 100% determined to go back to work when she can, it's predicated by all those ifs, right? If her family can find adequate and appropriate childcare. So how central is the childcare issue to this women's recession right now?
Yeah, Meghna, wow. Listening to her just echoed, you know, lots of things I'm hearing and seeing on Facebook from people. How important is childcare? Childcare is a critical piece of our economic infrastructure that allows parents to get to work, just like roads and bridges do for commuters. And so we just can't have a full economic recovery without adequate childcare. And if you think about it, like a lot of what you said really resonated, where I think about my generation of college-educated women has come closer to attaining a career and a family at the same time than any other generation before it. Yet this pandemic has really magnified gender inequality in the home and in the workplace. And women are essential workers in both places, but the lack of options and availability of childcare during this pandemic are forcing women once again into situations where they can choose only one or the other, and possibly for years to come.
Now, we have talked about how the impact is doubly or triply disproportionate on lower income women. But are we seeing this need to drop out of the labor market even amongst higher income women? I think you told our producer in advance of this show that, you know, we're even seeing like women surgeons not being able to either do their work fully or having to stop work. I mean, is that right?
Absolutely. So the survey that we did back in May and June found that among women who became unemployed during the pandemic, 25% said it was solely due to childcare. Now, we gave them lots of other options. They could have said, you know, my company went out of business, my hours were cut, I was furloughed. They said it was solely due to childcare. And so that's really telling you that the childcare issue is so important. And then we're seeing stories, you know, in the news, in the New York Times about surgeons who have given up their careers. We're seeing, you know, public health researchers, epidemiologists giving up their careers. And these are not things that you step back into very easily, right? As a surgeon, you have, you know, an affiliation with a hospital. You have a book of patients, right, that you need to maintain. You have, you know, a certain skill level. And then when you think about the loss to society, I mean, I would think we need every epidemiologist on the planet right now working on COVID. And so, you know, we're losing out as a society as well as the opportunities for these women to continue their careers. And stepping in and out, we know it's not easy. We know, especially during a recession, there's a lot more wage scarring that occurs. And, you know, those are trajectories that are, you know, if not lost, certainly slowed down by having taken time out of the labor market.
Yeah, that human capital there is what you're talking about. That's, I mean, if for no other reason, that's why all of us need to care about this issue. But just to drive home the childcare aspect, do I have this number right? That something like 40% of the entire U.S. workforce have children who are in the ages that they need some kind of childcare?
That's right. So 40% or 50 million workers live in a household with a child under age of 14 that would require some kind of supervision. And of these workers, 30% have all of their children under the age of 6, obviously requiring the most supervision. And so this is cutting across every income level. It certainly falls harder on low-income households than high-income. But it's cutting across every household in America and every industry and every occupation. And so that's why I say that, you know, we really just can't have an economic recovery until we can get every working parent back to work.
Okay. I honestly, when you said earlier, Alicia, that childcare is as critical to our nation's infrastructure as roads and bridges, like I want to make T-shirts like that and billboards. But so there's something else in addition here, and the childcare piece is part and parcel of this that I think the pandemic is really revealing, and I'd love to hear your take on this. That even as we have so much of the workforce, that 50% of the workforce this year being women, Do we still generally have a conception of work that's set up or not around the needs of women and families?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Claudia Golden, who's an economist, my mentor at Harvard University, for the last several years has been doing research showing that the way that work is organized and the way that it's rewarded, particularly for jobs that require sort of outsized hours, you know, face time kind of hours. Think a lot of client-facing jobs in law, business, you know, even in the upper, you know, healthcare and other places. Those jobs are just not organized in a way that someone can also be even an equal caregiver with a partner. And so, you know, I think that that is where we need to focus on how employers and also, you know, the culture needs to shift so that it's not an automatic that it's the woman who's going to pick up the slack when childcare goes away. Mm. And we've seen that time and again where there's a study done by the Center for American Progress that showed when households can't find childcare, it's women who cut back on being in the labor market. So when they find childcare, you know, 84% of women are participating in the labor market. When they don't find it, it's only 77%. And there's no decline among the dads, right? And so until we can make sure that work is organized in a way for everybody to participate equally in care, I think it's going to be hard to just, you know, find policies or practices to get our way out of this crisis we're in.
Well, as I mentioned, we did hear from a lot of women in the course of preparing for this hour. One of them is Ilza Maya Hamm, who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she owned a small business for the last 10 years, but the pandemic forced her to close that business down for good in July. Her training is actually as a lawyer, but a decade ago, when her children were born, she opted for owning that small business because the schedule was more flexible and she could be with her kids. And now that decision haunts Ilza.
I find myself going through a divorce during the pandemic when my business just closed. And I'm thinking back to if I, you know, had gone out to be a lawyer again and hadn't chosen to have a flexible job so I could raise my kids, I would probably still have that job now. I would have a steady income, most likely, and I would have health insurance benefits. But now I've lost everything, and I feel like I'm falling through the cracks.
That's Ilza Maya Hamm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, Professor Modestino, there's something that Nicole Mason said earlier in the show that I wanted to hear about from you, because we've done many, many hours of conversation. And I know, I mean, as you know, there are millions of pieces of paper, pages on the centrality of childcare. There's the issue of the wage gap between men and women, and then the gap being broadened when you consider women of color. But I also want to ask, though, in terms of moving forward, in terms of pushing forward, what is the role of employers here? Can they not actually be on the leading edge of getting us to a place where the workforce better supports women and families so that the impact of this she session isn't as long as it might be?
Yeah, employers certainly have a role to play here. And what's great is we've been seeing some employers step up during the pandemic. And then the question is, you know, how long will this continue after the pandemic ends? So, for example, in our survey, we found employers were putting in new policies like, you know, work from home, right, has become ubiquitous for some occupations and employers, with about 30% in our survey responding they're working from home, followed by, you know, providing backup childcare subsidies or having no penalty for paid time off. But over a quarter of our respondents said that there was no new policy put in place for COVID-19. So it's certainly not across the board. And low-income workers are suffering a lot more, where, you know, 70% of college-educated workers are getting flexibility in the workplace versus mm-hmm. only 18% of non-college workers. But we are seeing some employers step forward. So, for example, large businesses, manufacturers in particular, are saying this is a problem. This is affecting their bottom line. And so you see companies like Toyota, they brought in Bright Horizons to run a virtual learning center at one of their car plants in Kentucky so that parents can get to work. Or even small businesses like Kinesis in Portland, Oregon, they hired a teacher and they're running an online school in their empty office building for about five of the school-age kids of their 13 employees. And so you go and you drop your kid off at the office and you go back home and work. So they've kind of flipped the model, if you will. So employers are definitely getting creative. But the question is, you know, when schools do reopen, will any of these, you know, innovations stick? And will we remember that not everybody has access to affordable and high quality childcare?
Yes. And honestly, the examples that you gave are very heartening. And at the same time, we have to remember all the businesses that just closed down and may not ever reopen, right? I mean, the hit has been so big and so deep. You're pointing to innovations which are pretty inspiring. Can we rely on those sort of distributed grassroots level innovations to get us through this, or do we still need some sort of higher level state federal actions to support women in the workforce?
Oh yeah, we can't, you know, rely solely on the private sector to solve this problem for us. And even what's been done already at the federal level or even at the state levels, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. It's just not even close to meeting the needs of working parents. And I guess I would put these solutions into short-term versus long-term kinds of solutions. So in the short term, we don't just have like a childcare crisis. We have a childcare emergency, like, you know, pull the fire alarm, get out of the building kind of emergency. And, you know, some of the things we need to do is we need to recognize that the childcare industry is an essential component of the economy. And we need a large scale and immediate bailout. So in the CARES Act, we got some money for childcare providers, but it was less than what each of the three major airlines got in terms of a bailout. And it didn't go far, and that money's run out. And by one analysis, because of so many daycare closures, because what we've done is we've cut the number of kids they can serve in half because of social distancing requirements, and yet they have to pay the same number of staff to monitor those kids. That means that many of them are going to go out of business, and we've estimated we're going to lose about 450,000 childcare slots nationwide. In comparison, during the Great Recession, we only lost 120,000 childcare slots. So we're talking about a massive loss of childcare. One of the other, you know, sort of short-term emergency things we need to think about is, you know, really targeting these remaining Paycheck Protection Program dollars. So during the pandemic, only about 25% of childcare providers got a PPP loan. And for the most part, the amount was under $100,000, and it just didn't go very far. So in the short term, there's an immediate need for policymakers to step in and even just provide basic childcare.
And in the long term, the continuing need to recognize the fragility of the American labor force that this pandemic has revealed, particularly for women. Well, Alicia Sasser-Modestino, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to continue to hear your stories. So go to onpointradio.org on Twitter and Facebook and let us know how this recession is having an impact on you and your family. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.